Wittgenstein's will, in several ways, was like the will of Julius Caesar. First of all, it conferred a great benefit on the populace. Secondly, it was to be administered by triumvirs. And thirdly, it led to an enormous amount of disputation and accusation of bad faith. I'm not quite sure if it's right to call a group of three people triumvirs when one of them was a woman. But if you don't mind, I will continue to use that convenient expression. The original triumvirate was Rush Rhys, Elizabeth Anscombe, and Georg Henrik von Wright. As we were told yesterday, in his will, Wittgenstein left them, quote, all the copyright in my unpublished writings, and also the manuscripts and typescripts thereof to dispose of as they think best. They were to publish as many of the unpublished writings as they think fit, and they were to share the royalties and profits among themselves. People sometimes ask, why were these the three people chosen? I do not know the answer. Others here may know the answer. My own conjecture was that they corresponded to three different aspects of Wittgenstein's multifaceted personality. Von Wright, I think of as the corresponding to the Wittgenstein of logic and language of the Tractatus. Anscombe as corresponding to the philosophy of mind of the Philosophical Investigations, and Rhys as corresponding to the mystical Wittgenstein. Others will have their own conjectures. Now, during the decade following Wittgenstein's death, the heirs, who acted as literary executors, did valuable service in publishing serviceable editions reasonably promptly, and translations of the Philosophical Investigations and selections from other writings. Recent critical work on the Philosophical Investigations has shown that the edition of what appears as part one, despite some blemishes, was substantially sound. Much more controversial was the decision to include manuscript 144 as part two of the investigations, without any written warrant from Wittgenstein. No doubt the editors felt that it would be misleading in this first publication of the philosopher's post-Tractatus writings to conceal that after the completion of investigations part one, his thoughts on some crucial issues were taking a different turn. The Untersuchungen appeared with an en face translation by Elizabeth Anscombe. This has been subject to criticism, but I must record my opinion that it was a considerable achievement. In substance, it was faithful to Wittgenstein's German. Some emendations were made in a second edition, and when I was asked recently to propose further emendations for the 50th anniversary edition, which you will see on the shelves behind, I was only able to produce about a score. It's true that Anscombe's translation is not consistent in its translation of semi-technical terms, like Erperon and Bezeichnung. It's also true that it often differs from the translations suggested by Wittgenstein himself in his notes on an earlier translation by Rush Rhys. But there are often good reasons for the inconsistencies. And Wittgenstein's own English translations are not those of a native speaker of English. The Anscombe translation is fluent and readable and has been pretty generally accepted, rather astonishingly, as if it contained the ipsissima verba of Wittgenstein in the Anglophone world. I can think of no other English translation of a philosopher that has achieved such a canonical status. And I find the vivid lucidity of Anscombe's translation the more surprising because when she was writing in her own name, she wrote a rather crabbed and oblique English. Von Wright was prevented by illness from taking part in the editing of the investigations and had no part in the controversial decision to include a second part. He was involved in the subsequent publication of the Remarks on the Foundations of Mathematics. And this was something which, by 1969, seems to have slightly embarrassed him. He wrote, "Since this book consists of selections from Wittgenstein's writing, it occupies," he said, "a unique and perhaps not altogether happy position among the other publications from the Nachlass." These other publications were the blue and brown books, the 1914 notebooks, Philosophische Bemerkungen, and Zettel in 1967. Can you hear me all right, or would you? I don't need to put on a mic. Thank you. It was in summer 1967 that the part of the Nachlass which was known to exist in England was collected temporarily in Oxford and microfilmed for Cornell University, as we were reminded this morning. And later in the same year, papers in the Austrian part of the Nachlass were filmed at Cornell. It then became possible to purchase copies of these microfilms, and many universities throughout the world acquired them. However, the standard of photography was not good. The collection was incomplete, and parts of the manuscripts were deliberately omitted, in particular, the coded passages of the diaries. After the assembly of the manuscripts for the filming, Wittgenstein's triumvirs gave all their originals of the Wittgenstein papers to Trinity College, Cambridge, to be kept in the Wren Library. And those manuscripts physically belonged to Trinity, though the copyrights were retained by the original heirs. But they did something else in 1969. There was a deed of trust which handed over the copyright of the papers to a new set of trustees. These trustees were to consist originally of the heirs, of the original triumvirate. But henceforth, these were to be called the beneficiaries. That is to say, they were to receive the royalty and the profits. But a different body, notionally different to begin with, of trustees, was actually to own the copyrights in trust for the beneficiaries. New trustees could be appointed by the beneficiaries, and the trustees were to hold the copyrights and royalties on trust for the beneficiaries, which while they survived, and after the death of the last of them, on trust for Trinity College. Joachim Schurter and I are both trustees under this trust. We were not, of course, trustees under Wittgenstein's will, but we are members of the trust which succeeded the original heirs in 1969. It was in that year that von Wright provided the first full description and catalogue of the Nachlass, giving the numbers to the manuscripts and typescripts by which they've been known since. In that article in the Philosophical Review, he announced the forthcoming publication of the big typescript and of On Certainty. And he felt able to say, I quote, "With the publication of these posthumous works, the full body of Wittgenstein's philosophy has been made accessible to the public." And I think it can fairly be said that at the end of the 60s, an era in the reception of Wittgenstein came to an end. The main elements of his philosophy were available to the intellectual community. And if his philosophical insights have not had the worldwide impact they deserved, that has been because of changes in philosophical fashion rather than the inaccessibility of essential texts. But in the second period of Wittgenstein reception, interest began to grow in Wittgenstein's biography, and it became realized that the state of the Nachlass was not such that the early editions could be regarded as unquestionable representations of his definitive thought. What brought matters to a head, I think, was the publication of the big typescript by Rush Rees under the title Philosophische Grammatik in 1917. And this was the point at which I myself became involved because I was commissioned to prepare the English translation of the Grammatik. And that brought me into close contact with Rees's editorial methods. Rees has been very widely criticized for this publication. Hinteregger, for instance, has said, "The only halfway conventional book Wittgenstein left behind is TypeScript 213. Rees was supposed to edit it, but he ended up doing something quite different. He assembled a medley of materials from different sources, which was never intended by Wittgenstein to go together, and which are sometimes lifted out of an important context." End of quote. Now that was a little unfair. It's true, Rees did not publish the big typescript. But then Wittgenstein, as soon as he'd finished the big typescript, began tinkering with it, adding to it, cutting, transposing. It's not quite right to say that he never intended the passages chosen by Rees to go together. There may have been a day or two when he did. But the text which Rees published on the basis of a certain stage of Wittgenstein's revision is only one of many possible orderings that could claim Wittgenstein's authority. The main objection to Rees's published text is that it gives no indication of the amount of editorial activity that lay behind it. Cuts are made silently, transpositions merely hinted at, important material silently omitted. While I was translating Rees's text, I drew up a full account of the editorial decisions he'd made, and attached to them the justification, when there was one, as there usually was, in Wittgenstein's papers. And I wanted to put this as an introduction to the English version. But Rees forbade this on the ground that it would, quote, come between Wittgenstein and the reader, unquote. In my opinion, on the contrary, it would have made clear just how much had already come between Wittgenstein and the reader. Eventually, I published my account as a separate piece in a Festschrift for von Wright in an article called From the Big Typescript to the Philosophical Grammar. And relations between Rees and myself were thereafter rather strained. By the mid-1970s, many felt that a complete and definitive text of the Nachlass should be considered. In 1965, von Wright had found in Vienna a hitherto unknown manuscript of the Tractatus, which differed in several ways from the final published version. And in 1971, he and a number of colleagues published it in facsimile with a printed German text and an en face English translation, with a number of typographical devices to mark differences from the canonical text. This is the, quote, proto-tractatus that Brian has been telling us about earlier in the afternoon. Now, the proto-tractatus as published was handsome, and it was informative for scholars in a way that none of the previously published texts had been. But it gave an indication of how arduous and expensive a complete conventional, critical edition of the Nachlass would be. In April 1997, there was a symposium in Tübingen, attended by philosophers, linguists, and computer experts from Germany, England, Italy, France, Finland, and Canada, as well as publishers Blackwell and Zurkamp. The conference made clear to those participating that Wittgenstein's texts presented problems almost without parallel among 20th century writers because of the methods of composition which we've already been told about more than once in this conference. Problems which were well illustrated by the big typescript, having its origin in a series of small notebooks revised in the form of manuscript volumes, then in a typescript cut up and rearranged and so on. The text thus exists on six or more separate levels. I think the Tübingen Symposium marked the beginning of a new phase in Wittgenstein studies, the second phase of perception, by defining the extent of the problem and the realization that the appropriate first step to a complete edition must be the establishment of a computerized database. At that time, the word database was still so unfamiliar to the general public that it appeared in quotation marks in the newspaper reports of the conference. The creation of the database was entrusted to a team under the direction of Professor Heringer of Tübingen, Dr. Michael Nieder, Brian McGuinness, Joachim Schulter, and two Italian scholars, with financial support from the Fritz Thyssen Foundation. And the project began with high hopes. I reported on it for the Times Literary Supplement, and I wrote, "By the mid-1980s, it is hoped that the philosopher who once said that the only response to certain philosophical problems was silence will be represented by some 14 volumes of 500 pages each, which will contain every word of philosophy he ever committed to paper." Sadly, the project proved abortive. The second phase of Wittgenstein reception is altogether rather a sad story. About half the Nachlass was transcribed into machine-readable form, but during the lifetime of the project, not a single volume of text appeared. The collaborators could not agree with each other, and the Tübingen Wittgenstein archive was dissolved amid acrimony. After the dissolution of the Tübingen project, Professor Heringer handed over a certain amount of material to a venture in Norway, which we heard something about this morning, the Norwegian Wittgenstein project, which preceded the Bergen one. Nieder moved from Tübingen to Cambridge, and he, Isabel Weiss, began a new project for a complete transcription of the posthumous writings into a database. In 1981, the three trustees applied to the Fonds, the FWF, the Austrian Government Research Foundation, for support for Nieder. And in 1982, the FWF funded a pilot program. Application was made for further support to the British Academy for computing expenses. The philosophy section of the Academy, of which I was then the chairman, refused support to the Cambridge project on the grounds that it did not wish to take part in the quarrel between the former Tübingen partners. And that led to a considerable amount of internal controversy in the Academy. Despite renewal of funding for two further years, Nieder did not produce any publishable text. Von Wright began to have serious doubts about his capacity to produce a Gesamtausgabe. Anscombe continued to support applications to the FWF, and it is possible that her recommendations were taken to represent the unanimous opinion of the trustees, until in 1987, von Wright wrote to dissociate himself. But then again, in 1989, a substantial grant was made by the FWF, this time at the request of all the trustees, on the basis of a transcript of manuscript 105-6, which was produced for their inspection in 1988. In 1989, Rees died. For some time, the trustees had been giving thought to the future of the Nachlass after their death. And here again, one is reminded of Roman history. You may remember that the Emperor Diocletian divided the empire up and had, in fact, four emperors. There was a senior Western emperor and a senior Eastern emperor, each called an Augustus. But each Augustus had a junior partner called a Caesar who would succeed him as an Augustus in due course. Well, some such arrangement was in the mind of the trustees, of the original beneficiaries. Each privately nominated a successor to take over from them at the time of their death. Anscombe nominated Anselm Müller of Trier, Rees nominated Peter Winch, and von Wright nominated myself. Though none of us, certainly I didn't, knew of these nominations until quite some time later. I was, of course, enormously honored when I learned of it. But when Rees died, Peter Winch then became a trustee. In spring 1990, I was invited also to join the trust, von Wright having decided he would wish me to become a trustee before he himself had ceased to be a member of the board. And from 1990 onwards, the proceedings of the Nachlass Verwalter, which up till then had been very informal, they became more formal, with roughly annual meetings, minuted by a secretary who, from 1991 until his death, was Winch. One of my first duties as a trustee in May 1990 was to join a meeting with Blackwell's to discuss the possibility of a new edition of all Wittgenstein's philosophical writings. Not the entire Nachlass at that time, but of all the philosophical writings. And the minutes read as follows: those present agreed that such an edition was in principle desirable. The material involved, if published in its entirety, would result in about 30 substantial printed volumes. There was some discussion about whether these volumes should encompass the quite considerable overlap and duplication between discrete notes and texts, or whether they should be reduced to about 15 more selected volumes. The tendency of the meeting was to prefer the latter option. A number of issues were discussed at the meeting of Dito, but the main item of discussion was what relation this proposed edition should have to the work being done by Nilo. Blackwell's, after some hesitation, were quite firm they did not wish to have any collaboration. They disliked the format of the existing project, which they felt to be too large to be conveniently published in book form, and they did not think that there would be the possibility of setting up a reporting arrangement which would really work. I quote the final line of the discussion: "It was felt that the benefits of collaborating with Nilo were considerable in terms of taking advantage of very sophisticated and, as far as the meeting was able to gauge, intellectually sound work. The disadvantages were administrative and, to some extent, political." After that meeting, the trustees sent Nilo an ultimatum. They agreed to continue his permission to work on the manuscripts and to continue their support on conditions which included the following: their support for his grant from the FWF. Within 1 year, i.e. before 4th of May 1991, you are to produce, in a form ready for publication, volumes 107, 108, 208, and 210, according to the numbering in the von Wright catalogue. If those volumes have not been produced in satisfactory form by that time, you will take no further part in the production of the Gesamtausgabe of Wittgenstein's works. Given Nido's constant failure to produce camera-ready copy, some of the trustees began to doubt whether any substantial transcription had actually taken place. And on their behalf, I inspected Nido's office in Trinity College, Cambridge, and did indeed see the 10,000 or more pages of computer printer. And so far as I could tell on brief inspection, their transcriptions were of high quality. However, in spite of repeated questioning of Nilo, both in private and later before the other trustees, I was unable to obtain from him a satisfactory account of the reasons for delay. So far as I could ascertain, he had spent much of the time designing software for formatting the pages to be published according to his own taste in design. Now, when he'd started working in 1977, desktop publishing was in the future. But by 1990, it appeared to me that there were many commercially available packages that would enable the novice to produce camera-ready copy as satisfactory from either the aesthetic or scholarly point of view as his own output. May 1991 came and went and no volumes appeared, and the trustees severed all communication with him as editor of a possible Gesamtausgabe, but agreed they would support the publication of the two volumes that had existed since 1987. They said that by the end of 1991 he had to return all material to the Wren Library and give up his office in Trinity. He did so, and again, no volumes were presented before the predefined date. During the 80s, another initially abortive project had been proceeding simultaneously. This was the collaborative Norwegian Wittgenstein project, which I think transcribed about 3,000 pages. But those responsible failed to apply for copyright clearance from the trustees, believing it was not necessary for publication in machine-readable form. And when belatedly approached, this was before I joined them, the trustees refused their support, and the project came to a halt in 1987. It was only when Klaus appeared on the scene that the story began to take a hopeful turn. When he drew up plans for the Wittgenstein archive here, and the project went through various stages before it reached what we now have in front of us. The initial thing was a complete machine-readable version of the Nachlass, but a lot of issues about publication were left for the future. The new project was punctilious in its relation with the trustees, and I think the trustees, who now included Winch and myself, were cooperative with the project from the outset, though no doubt we were rather slow moving. The agreement between the trustees and the University of Bergen was signed in March 1992, giving the university permission to copy and make machine-readable transcripts and to make them available to scholars in Bergen. It was also given conditional permission to distribute and sell machine-readable transcriptions under three conditions: satisfactory financing to be assured, the parties to agree on the sharing of royalties, and the parties were to agree on a publisher. And the trustees wrote that they were favorably impressed by the sample transcriptions, and they wrote, I quote, that they are hopeful that the work at Bergen may eventually serve as a basis for the preparation of a printed Gesamtausgabe. Well, the conditions laid down by the trustees did not take long to fulfill. The University of Bergen, with some other foundations, continued the funding. The trustees agreed to charge no royalties on the first 200 copies of the CD-ROM, and Oxford University Press was chosen as a publisher, and the three parties, the trustees, the University Press, and Bergen, agreed together for the publication of a facsimile with the entire Nachlass, including the coded passages. It took a little longer, I think, for the agreement to be reached for the sale of the transcription as well as the facsimile. But then in December 1992, this complicated story took an unexpected twist. Nader presented the trustees with six volumes of text ready for the printer. And this put the trustees in a difficult position. In the light of past experience, they did not wish to cooperate further with Nader in the production of the Gesamtausgabe. On the other hand, it seemed harsh and unfair to the Austrian funders to forbid the publication of the result of such long periods of work and such great sums of expense. in the event, they decided that while they wouldn't take an initiative in publishing the text, they wouldn't stand in the way of their publication. And they authorized Nadeau to sign a contract with Springer of Vienna for the publication of manuscripts 105 to 114 and typescripts 208 to 213. That's to say, the manuscripts and typescripts from 1929 up to and including the big typescript. Rights of electronic publication were explicitly excluded so as not to interfere with the Bergen work. And the trustees minuted that Nadeau's work should not be regarded as constituting part of any possible future collected edition of the Wittgenstein Nachlass. The trustees resolved that the FWF should be told that any further support they might wish to give to the editing of Wittgenstein's papers should usefully be applied rather to the Bergen project. Since then, several volumes have appeared of the Wiener Ausgabe, an introductory volume by Nadeau, the two volumes that have been ready since 1978, and by 1998, four further volumes appeared. Most recently, in 2000, there appeared the volume containing the big typescript. Unlike Rees, Nadeau has published the typescript exactly as produced, without taking account of the annotations and emendations. This seems to be a very sensible editorial decision. He promises two further volumes which will take account of the reworking of the big typescript, which will be volumes 12 and 13 of the Wiener Ausgabe. When they have appeared, plus some other volumes which have been in the pipeline for quite a long time now, the trustees' permission to Nadeau to publish Wittgenstein texts will come to an end. The publisher's blurb say that an extension of the edition is intended, but any such extension would have to be agreed with the trustees. And any such agreement would have to wait on an eventual decision about a possible hard copy Gesamtausgabe founded on the Bergen database. During the 90s, therefore, and the 90s are the third and happier stage of the reception of Wittgenstein, there were two projects engaged in the dissemination of Wittgenstein's unpublished papers. Rather confusingly, each of the projects, one in Bergen and one in Cambridge, used the name the Wittgenstein Archive. Of course, the actual Wittgenstein papers were in Trinity College, the Bodleian Library, and the Austrian National Library. The Cambridge papers from 1994 have been, the Cambridge Nadeau papers, have been located in a concrete and glass house designed and owned by Colin St. John Wilson. Colin St. John Wilson was the architect of the new British Library. I was at that time the chairman of the British Library, and so I saw quite a lot of him. The three-cornered relationship between Nadeau, Wilson and myself sometimes had its difficulties, but Wilson is an admirer of Nadeau's work, and he is himself a student of Wittgenstein's architectural work and has written a book on Wittgenstein's architecture. The Bergen project modified and developed during the last years of the century. It took some time to overcome initial difficulties about permissions from the three libraries. And OUP met a number of technical difficulties by 1995, which led eventually to the decision not to publish the facsimile separately, but to publish it as it has now been published, with the discs containing facsimile, diplomatic transcript, and normalized transcript. The edition has sold quite widely. I don't know, I hope Klaus will tell us later, how many copies have been sold. But as they've started paying royalties to the trustees, I assume it must mean that more than 200 have been sold. The death of Peter Winch in 1997 was a great blow to the trustees. He had served them as a devoted secretary and had been skillful in conducting the difficult tripartite negotiations, both with Nilo and Springer and with Bergen and OEP. One of his last acts was to prepare a second edition of Culture and Value, the English version of Vermischte Bemerkungen. This second edition included the publication of Wittgenstein's only known poem. And then at the same time, Hermann Verlag published the diaries of the 1930s. Along with the Coda diaries, the earliest version of part one of the Philosophische Untersuchungen was discovered. And this has very recently been published, along with four other stages of composition of that work, in a critical genetical edition by Joachim Schulter, with others, building on earlier work by von Reitz and Neimann. It's available at the back of the room. It gives a definitive history of the genesis and status also of the material published as part two of the investigations. At about the same time, a second edition of the critical edition of the Tractatus by McGinnis and Schulter also appeared. In 1996, Elizabeth Anscombe was involved in a serious car accident and suffered injuries to the head. In succeeding years, she suffered occasional periods of disorientation, and this sometimes made it difficult to conduct the business of the Wittgenstein Trust, to such a point that in the 2 years before her death in 2000, no meeting of the Trust was held. This was doubly sad in view of the enormous contribution she had made during her lifetime to the reception and understanding of Wittgenstein's philosophy. The trustees at present are Georg Henrik von Wright, the sole surviving heir, sole surviving member of the original triumvirate, and then the added trustees, Nicholas Denyer, Peter Hacker, Joachim Schulter, and myself. And we continue to hold the copyrights on trust for von Wright, the sole surviving heir, until in due course they are handed over to Trinity College, Cambridge, when the trustees will be succeeded by the committee of editors, but the trust will come to an end, and Trinity College, Cambridge will own not only the physical papers, but the copyrights too. Now, 50 years after Wittgenstein's death, everything that he has written is available to scholars. Only 10 years ago, the learned world had virtually despaired of this. In 1991, Hinteregger wrote, "There is a veritable scholarly industry of books and papers on Wittgenstein going on unremittingly, oblivious to the critical importance of the notebooks and other unpublished materials." And as long as the coded passages were excluded from publication, great importance was attached to them by those who were more interested in Wittgenstein's sexuality than in his philosophy. This situation has all now drastically changed. I wish to end by reflecting on the story with a view to seeking advice from those here present with respect to decisions that remain to be taken. The future. The learned world has had a long wait for the complete publication of Wittgenstein's work. The most disquieting part of the story I've told was the gap of 17 years between Nader's original involvement with the Gesamtausgabe project and the appearance of the first volumes of the Wiener Ausgabe. To the extent that the trustees supported his funding applications and gave him a virtual monopoly of editorial access to the text, they must share the responsibility for this delay. I do not know enough about the events in Tübingen in the latter half of the 70s to assign responsibility for the breakdown of the project. There are others here who can speak with much greater authority if they wish to do so. But by 1987, when Nader had spent a further five unproductive years in charge of a second publishing project, it was surely time, as von Wright saw, for the trustees to break off relations with him. When I myself became a trustee, one of my main concerns was to try, with only partial success, to bring about a clean break between the trust and Nudo. Shortly before her death, Anscombe wrote to me that the trustee's decision to continue with Nudo had been vindicated by the eventual publication of the Hansen Wiener Ausgabe volumes. I don't myself believe that this is correct. The volumes that have been published have indeed contained accurate transcriptions and appropriate critical annotation. And to this extent, the doubts expressed about Nudo's scholarly competence have proved unfounded. But still no reason has been given why it should have taken so long and cost such enormous sums of money to bring this scholarly output to production. The page layout on which Nudo spent so much time and to which he attaches almost mystical significance seems to me no more conducive to the study of Wittgenstein than others which could have been produced at a fraction of the cost. The lack of running heads makes the text difficult to consult, and the unwieldy size of the volumes makes them unsuitable for desk use. They would be more at home on a coffee table or a gospel lectern in a church. The shorter critical genetic edition of the Untersuchungen is, to my mind, a far superior example of how a critical Wittgenstein should appear in hard copy. It is aesthetically as attractive as Nudo's volumes and was less expensive to produce and is far easier to consult. If there is to be a full critical edition of the Nachlass, that and not the Wiener Ausgabe is the model to be followed. But now that Bergen and Oxford University Press have produced on CD-ROM the entire Nachlass in facsimile and two kinds of transcription, is there really a case for an authorized Gesamtausgabe in hard copy? The repetitive nature of Wittgenstein's manuscripts with so many texts existing in multiple drafts makes them, in my own view, more suitable for study in electronic form than in hard copy. The existing CD-ROMs are indeed not perfect, as we heard this morning, and it would be good to have an electronic edition not tied to particular platforms and particular search engines. But in my view, an improved electronic edition is a more realistic goal than a multi-volume hard copy edition. However, there may be others here who think differently. Hinteregger, in his influential 1991 paper, argued for the superiority of a decent critical text to the convenience promised by the greater searchability of machine-readable version. I'll be most interested to hear, in the course of discussion, what the preferences are of those here assembled. I conclude with a final word about translations. Wittgenstein's works have now been translated with the approval of the trustees into many different languages, including Chinese. From time to time, proposals are made to the trustees for complete translations into other languages of the entire Nachlass. Hitherto, the trustees have refused permission, and in my view, rightly. The study of Wittgenstein at a level which demands the kind of comparison between variants and revisions which only the entire Nachlass permits, that kind of study cannot be profitably undertaken except by scholars who understand German. It would be a futile endeavor, I think, to be doing it on a translated text of the entire Nachlass. And the production of entire Nachlass translations into many languages, in my view, could only divert Wittgenstein's studies into an amateur scholasticism. I think a related objection can be made to the proliferation of different translations in the same language, for instance, English. We are fortunate in that most of the English translations of Wittgenstein's works are of a high standard. When errors are found in them, it's better that they should be remedied in a second edition of the existing translation rather than in the production of entirely new translations. Otherwise, readers ignorant of German may take differences between translators' style for evidence of variation or development in Wittgenstein's own thoughts. But those concluding remarks of mine are my own personal opinion, and I will be very happy to hear from others who do not share those opinions. Thank you.